Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. How about that jobs report? My gosh, the analysts are surprised by the numbers here. According to the early reports, U.S. employers added stunning 236,000 jobs in February. The unemployment rate falls to 7.7%. Nice to start out the day with some good news. Senator Carl Levin stepping down from the U.S. Senate in 2 years, and he has served in that position since 1979. What a run. And we do want to acknowledge the senior senator at the top of the show here today. Immediately, the speculation picks up on who'll take over. Analyst Bill Ballinger mentions Congressman Gary Peters and former Rep. Mark Schauer amongst Democrats. Amongst Republicans, Congressman Mike Rogers, who reps Lansing and East Lansing, along with Candace Miller from up north. Bill Schuette, maybe. And it's as early as it can be, but it's the speculation is impossible to stop. So, and for the record, State Senator Gretchen Whitmer said no to the opportunity yesterday. They've already asked her. Quote, "I'll rule out three things now, governor, U.S. Senate, and Pope." "They're not on my agenda," she says. Yesterday in Detroit, federal Judge Bernard Friedman stayed his ruling on a lesbian couple's challenge to Michigan's gay marriage ban, choosing to wait until the Supreme Court rules on two other federal cases, and those rulings are expected in June. With me now for reaction to Judge Friedman's decision is Penny Gardner. She's the president of the Lansing Association for Human Rights, a local LGBT advocacy group. Welcome, Penny.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. What do you make of this Michigan verdict yesterday, or this decision not to decide, I guess?
Well, at first I was, like, disappointed. Of course, I want instant gratification on these things, just like the Equal Rights Amendment for women and everything else. I want instant gratification. So I, of course, in my protesting mind, was disappointed that he kicked it down the can down the road,
yeah,
as has been said. But as thinking about it, I think that Friedman's suggestion that the two women tie their second parent adoption of their mutual children to the marriage amendment, and to that it had to do with being denied equal rights around marriage, because marriage, if you're married as a opposite sex couple, these adoption things it's easy ride.
Right.
So that was that. And so then I thought, well, maybe he did, even though he was appointed by Ronald Reagan, the judge. I have to, like,
he goes back that far, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I read that today, and then also that it was his suggestion that they tie it to the marriage thing, which then at first made me think, well, that he's subverting them or something like that. That there's something like that. But I think that in all honesty, that he wanted it to test the constitutional business about our not being able to marry in this state.
Okay.
And so then tying it to the Supreme Court decision that's to be made on the California amendment in June, I guess.
Yes.
And so, but I really liked the women's lawyer said, that, well, maybe the Supreme Court decision could be helped by you making a decision now rather than waiting for it. And he didn't take that. But the defense of the Michigan not allowing same-sex couples to marry is based on a decision in 1971, not in Minnesota. And don't ask me to go into that. You'll have to read it for yourself, because
okay,
it's kind of confusing. But I do believe with the population and all these stories that we've been reading about that things are turning for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender couples being granted equal rights in marriage.
Any opinion on how the U.S. High Court is apt to rule in June?
Well, there's wishful thinking, and then there's the pessimist about who's on the Supreme Court and the Roberts Supreme Court and stuff like that. But I don't know if they do respond to people and the people and the law, and that this is a country based on equality of rights for all, that how can they continue to isolate a population of based on who they love?
But strictly politically, do you expect it to be close? I'll take
yes.
that as a yes.
I'm hoping. Call me back in June.
Penny, we appreciate your stopping by here for your perspective.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Since 2010, Michigan and most other states have been moving toward what are called Common Core State Standards. That's a movement that aims to create consistent learning goals for school kids across the country. Michigan joined that movement early on, but it's now among a growing list of states beginning to discuss whether to drop out of Common Core. Republican State Rep. Tom McMillan has filed a bill that would do just that. Among other concerns, McMillan and some others fear that Common Core means giving up too much local control over school curriculums. Here to discuss the issue is State Representative Tom McMillan of Rochester. Tom, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And University Distinguished Professor in Education Bill Schmidt, who is a Common Core advocate. Welcome to you, Bill.
Thank you.
Representative McMillan, we'll try to get through all of your concerns triggered by Common Core, but I know one of your biggest is giving up local control of curriculum. Why is local control important?
Well, I mean, you know, there are some bureaucrats and people who make money off the system who served best by the parents and the local teacher, but that's what I believe. I believe they know what's best for the student, and not some bureaucrat, you know, hundreds or even thousands, you know, many miles away in other states. And so, you know, local. I've been fighting for local control since the early '90s when I go to hearings with Senator Gil Dinello and Doug Carl fighting the Michigan model. So I think that that's where the decisions need to be made at the local level.
Bill Schmidt, what do you make of that argument?
Well, Mark, I think it's important to recognize that the whole of the Common Core standards is not about school control. It's about excellence. It's about providing our children with the best opportunities in mathematics and English and language arts for them to be competitive internationally. We know when our children compete in these international tests, they don't do very well. We continue to end up on the bottom ends of these distributions. A recent one showing we were about 24th out of Europe and Asian economies that we typically compete with. So we don't do very well in this. And let's just look back briefly to the history of this. Actually, this began when the governors, facing a common problem, that they had jobs in their states not being filled because the educational system did not prepare a workforce that could take on those kinds of responsibilities, that they then decided by common sense that they would address this problem together, because they then could look collectively, and that would help in defining what is commonly needed to educate all children in this system. So it's been driven by the governors and the states that they have decided that they need to address this common problem, that we're not preparing our kids adequately for the world of today.
Tom McMillan, Bill Schmidt suggests that there's a doubt about whether local standards are really adequate. How do we know local standards are adequate?
Well, Mark, let me just say that the only mathematician on that Common Core Validation Committee, James Milgram, that the state's governors were using, has been out attacking Common Core and saying that this is going to harm our students and put us years behind compared to international students. So, you know, when your goal is common, you know, the bar tends to keep getting lower and lower because, you know, government doesn't like to look like a failure. So this is just central planning. There's people like the professor here that might be making a lot of money off of this stuff, but, you know, the local level is where we need to have these have the control.
Bill Schmidt, want to respond?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, looking back and saying local control is adequate, how well has that worked for us? We continue to show up poorly on these international tests. Even on our own national assessment, only about 20-25% of our students are defined as being proficient. So what has been the local school model, if you will, has simply not taken us anywhere where we need to go. So there's no evidence to suggest that we should stay where we have been. And this, again, I remind you, is not about the federal government. It is not about bureaucrats. It's about the governors looking at a common problem that they confront, which is the education of their future workforce. And they decided and they worked with people to develop these Common Core standards. So this is really not about control of schools. Again, it is about excellence. It is about giving our children a chance. And these have been internationally benchmarked. And they have been established as being competitive with those countries whose children perform the best in the world.
Mr. Schmidt talks. Go ahead.
I'll tell you, respond real quickly, then we'll move on to standardized testing here.
Mr. Schmidt says that it's not about national curriculum, but Obama said just in his State of the Union speech, he was touting that with Race to the Top, they are beginning to implement curricula, national curricula, and that's through this Common Core.
Okay. I think you've both staked out your territory here pretty well. Common Core would also mean adopting new standardized testing models as well. Tom McMillan, is that a problem as you see it?
Well, standardized testing models is not a problem at all. When I was president of Prevail Academy School Board, we had NWEA testing models. But what is very troubling in Common Core is the databases, the privacy that will be gone from our students because government will be tracking at the highest levels everything. We're putting in all kind of software, thanks to grants for getting ready for Common Core, that'll track kids, and it'll be a central planner's dream, but as far as freedom, a nightmare.
Any response to that, Bill Schmidt?
The tests are not that different from the tests we currently give. And states are moving more and more to trying to track children, not for keeping track of some centralized system of planning, but so that we can find out what children are learning and what they're not learning, so that we can address their needs. Again, the focus of the Common Core is around building excellence for our children. We have not had that. We need to move beyond where we are to give our children a chance for the future. And I think there is nothing here in this work that is being supported by the Common Core around developing national curricula. In fact, that is just the opposite. Teachers are now being empowered to teach the way they need to teach the children in their classroom. They no longer need to worry about what it is to teach. That's all that's been established by the standards. It's not about which textbooks to use. It's not about a style of teaching. It's about laying out a map that's logically developed to best develop the ideas involved in mathematics.
Tom McMillan, why don't you respond?
Well, I mean, just, you know, it's not about excellence. I mean, the national experts, some of the people that were on the Common Core panel, those that are not making a lot of money off the system, they're clearly saying that this is not about excellence. It's about making everybody common, and it's about reducing, it's about a ceiling and not a floor. We don't need nationally to be taught exactly the same thing all around the nation. And I know Mr. Schmidt doesn't like the local control. He said so at gatherings, one that a friend of mine was at back in 2011. There are people that think central planning is a great idea and that bureaucrats and, people from far away know what's best for the student, but it's a nightmare. Might work in, Mao may like it in Lenin, but not here in America.
Bill Schmidt, it seems to me that adopting a Common Core alone is no guarantee of a top-notch education. The key to it is the standard, correct? It has to be high. It has to be competitive. You are alleging that by being vigilant about worldwide standards, that standard will be higher than if we rely on local standards. That is the heart of your argument, correct? That's
correct. And in fact, these standards have been, if you look at the information that's known about this, these standards are competitive by international benchmark standards. One can talk about whether they are or they are not. Mathematicians from all over the country were involved in the development of these standards. There were sound, solid mathematicians involved in this process.
Hold on, Representative.
And they put this together. And by comparison to the standards of these top-achieving countries in the world, these standards are very similar. They're the U.S. version thereof, but they adhere to the principles that we've discovered through a lot of work over the last 10 years about what other countries do with their children that enables them to perform so well.
Go ahead, Tom McMillan. You have the floor.
Well, I mean, like I said, the only mathematician on the validation committee says that Mr. Schmidt is wrong and that it's bogus. Look, we have 50 laboratories in the United States. We're unique. Now, a lot of countries do a lot of central planning and take a lot of freedoms away. We say what's best. We allow states to figure out what is best. We certainly have national tests like the NAEP and SAT and ACT. We have plenty of ways to evaluate growth and the NWEA and other testing. So, you know, there's just no need to centralize and go and take away control and decision-making from the locals.
Go ahead. Bill Schmidt.
I think the representative said it well. The states know where to go. And these 47 states have decided to go with the Common Core. They have made that choice. It is their choice. And they have decided that through economies of scale, they can work together to develop a set of standards, which are far from a ceiling. They simply provide what all children in this nation need to know in order to be economically competitive. And what one mathematician may say or not say does not represent the mathematics community.
What do you make of Mr. Milgram's turning against the Common Core, though? How do you interpret that?
Well, he has an opinion. I know him, and we have talked together. And he has an opinion, and other people have opinions. And I don't know that we should ever make a decision based on any one individual's opinion. There are many mathematicians, research mathematicians, at this university and in other universities who strongly support these Common Core standards. So to base an argument on one individual is just not a very broad argument. It's not a very logical argument.
Tom McMillan, what's the reception been to your proposal so far?
Well, we're going to have a hearing in Education Committee on the 20th of this month. And, you know, there are people that still believe in local control and don't want to give it to bureaucrats and people making money off the system like Mr. Schmidt. So, I mean, it's something that you know, and obviously it's bipartisan. The elected state superintendent in Indiana, the Democrat, is fighting to get them out of Common Core. And, you know, there's others that really see this as a dumbing down and a way to actually make everybody common as opposed to exceptional, and that's not what America's about.
Michigan School Superintendent Mike Flanagan recently called for math and science teacher salaries in the state to be in the $100,000 a year area. Bill Schmidt, any response to that? Good idea?
I don't know that I know enough to necessarily respond to that. I think that in order to succeed in providing the kind of education we need for our students here in Michigan, we have to help teachers be the best they can. And we want to attract the best possible teachers to teaching, especially in areas, difficult areas like mathematics and science. And so I'm sure that the superintendent has thought this through. I don't have any particular reactions to that.
Tom, we're out of time, I'm sorry to say, but we appreciate both of you joining us here today. Republican State Representative Tom McMillan and Professor Bill Schmidt. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
its current state, I'm Mark Bayshore. The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroth joins us now to deconstruct our victory, the Michigan State victory over Wisconsin last night. Hi, Joe. Joe, are you there? Okay. Well, we've got Joe Rexroth that I'm confident we're going to reconnect with here momentarily. Joe Rexroth of the Detroit Free Press. It was it was another halftime adjustment. I think the Spartans walked pretty much in the second half, and there's not an awful lot of offense here to this Wisconsin team, and we managed to prevail here last night. Joe Rexroth, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Well done. Yes. No, we can hear you.
How you doing, Mark?
Hey, I'm good. Whatever halftime adjustments the Spartans made last night certainly did the trick against Wisconsin. Are you more encouraged about this team than before last night?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a step forward. You know, in one key way, just that Michigan State played really hard and, you know, outplayed a team or outworked a team that's known for really outworking opponents. And, you know, jumping all over the floor, getting steals. I mean, 16 steals is a season high, and you don't usually get that many against Wisconsin. And obviously because Keith Appling hit some shots and felt better, and it was just sort of a feel-good night for Michigan State. So I think that in itself is certainly a positive step heading into the postseason.
You made a point in your article this morning in the Free Press and the State Journal that we saw some fun exhibited by the Spartans. How important is that with the postseason so close?
Well, it's a thing. It's been almost a month now, really, if you think about it. They beat Michigan, February 12th, and that was and then it was maybe a little bit of, oh, we've arrived, and maybe, you know, some distractions came out of that. And, of course, the past couple weeks it's been all glum faces and, you know, tough losses. And so, yeah, I think it's important, especially for Appling, because he's really been under strain and has not been able to hit shots. But, yeah, I think it is important. I mean, it's just good for team chemistry. And, I think that's one of the things that really can help Michigan State.
At the risk of putting the cart before the horse here, let's talk about Michigan and Indiana, which is critical now for Michigan State. Sunday at 4 p.m., we got a few Spartans that will be quietly rooting for the Wolverines, I think, Sunday afternoon. What are the chances Michigan will prevail there?
Oh, I'd say Indiana really has been able to get up for these big games. You know, they go to Ohio State and they look great in winning. They come up here and win. It's going to be tough for Michigan, but, you know, it should be a great crowd, and obviously Michigan is also playing for a championship. So, I mean, I guess if you ask me, I would maybe still give Indiana a slight edge, but it should be a good game, and there's definitely a chance. And you're right. I mean, you know, some Michigan State fans will not want to do it and can't bring themselves to do it, but if Michigan wins, Michigan State can have a fourth Big Ten banner in the last 5 years by beating Northwestern.
And our regular season finale on Sunday is Northwestern at 6. What to look for there?
Well, Northwestern's pretty bad. You know, lost at home to Penn State last night, and that's an indication of, you know, I don't expect this game to be competitive. Whether Michigan State knows it's playing for a championship or not, I mean, Michigan State will get the win, finish 13-5, and then either be the 4 seed in the Big Ten tournament if there's a 4-way tie, or could be the 2 or 3 seed if Indiana wins.
Very good. The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroth. Thank you, Joe. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, we'll talk about the world of self-publishing, which has really taken off in recent years. Also, a young Michigan artist, a teenager, has been named to Carnegie Hall's inaugural youth orchestral. We'll learn all about that coming up. Also, Spartan hockey and more, all on the way on Current State. Current Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. Every budding author dreams of the thrill of seeing their name in print. The book publishing world can be a tough nut to crack, as many a rejected writer has found for many decades, but the explosion of social media and other forms of electronic communication is opening more avenues for writers to self-publish their work. Now, tomorrow night, Schuller's Bookstore in Okemos hosts two authors for a friendly debate on the merits of self-publication versus going the traditional route of finding a large publishing house. Jenny Milchman is author of The Cover of Snow. She's published by Ballantine Random House. She's one of the speakers tomorrow night. She joins us by phone right now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
And Rick Mercer's in our studio here at Current State. He's the author of Caribbean Moon, and Rick is a self-published author from Holt. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Mark.
Let's start with the more traditional approach with a traditional publishing company. Jenny, how does that work? I mean, has that changed much over the years?
You know, I think one of the things is that it hasn't changed much over the years, and that with the traditional publishing system, there's a large, you know, entrenched group of gatekeepers, and the writer kind of keeps improving his or her craft as she gets rejections. They're inevitable. They're inevitable probably on every publishing path. It's just a question of who's doing the rejecting. But if you want to be published with a major house, you basically have to get an agent, and then an agent has to find an editor at a publishing house who loves your book, and then the editor has to find other people at that publishing house who also love the book and agree that it's worth taking on. And then finally, there's the magic of an offer, and if you're lucky, you get to tour around the country and talk to radio hosts and authors like Rick here.
Self-publication, then, Rick. What is exactly meant by that?
Self-publication is exactly that. You take things into your own hands. You decide, or by necessity, ignore the steps that Jenny discussed. You don't seek an agent. You don't seek a traditional publishing contract. And with the advent of e-books and that format these days, you can publish on your own. You don't have to go through that process.
You still got to get a book published. You've still got to get it on store shelves. How does that happen?
Well, my focus was not that. My focus was the e-book world. The print book is just a minor part of our sales. Our e-books were our major focus. And with the advent of the Kindle and the Nook and the Smashwords forums or formats with iTunes and Kobo and the like, it was an easy process to do. And it's easy accessibility to folks who want to read that way. There's still a lot of folks like to have a book in their hand, but
so what was it? Did it just mean an awful lot less for you to hold your first hardcore copy of Caribbean Moon? It just wasn't high on your list of priorities, or did it still feel good? But it ranks down the list of priorities.
Yeah,
it never did.
It never was a priority for me to see my book in a bookstore. And I know that's a little different, but I approach the thing from my love for writing is immense, and reading as well. But I also have a strong business background, and I thought, well, if I wanted to do this, I want to do it on an efficient business model. And I chose that. I chose my audience. I chose the type of book we wanted to write, and it worked very well for us.
Do you find Jenny Milchman? Do you find the advantages of self-publication pretty seductive, or what?
I think that there are three fantastic ways to publish these days, and I think it's wonderful news for writers and wonderful news for readers, because it means that there's more books out there and more ways to get them. You know, I think the way you two gentlemen were talking about it probably puts your finger on exactly why I hung in there. It took me 13 years to get published. A lot of those years were really painful ones. But for me, holding a book in my hands, and right now we are on this crazy, wonderful tour of 7 months on the road of going to bookstores and libraries, and that was very important to me. You know, libraries and bookstores kind of saved me as a child, and they were just wrapped up in my writing dreams. But I think that Rick's right, and readers, you know, there are plenty. It seems that books are holding steady as a medium, which is wonderful news, but readers certainly love reading digitally as well, and the ease of application, you know, is a great thing because they can get Rick's book, you know, in their hands within 15 seconds. And, you know, I think it's wonderful news on every front. For me personally, it was just very important to walk into that bookstore. And, you know, yesterday I got to see a window full of my books, and it was a real, you know, just personally kind of a moment for me.
So none of that happens for you, Rick?
Not that way.
The book tour, the bookstores, the face-to-face, the press in the flesh, that kind of thing.
We've had some of that, you know, certainly. And Shula Shamar Night will be our second or third event. But it's not something that, I mean, I tip my hat to Jenny. She's a dedicated woman. She knew what she wanted, and I have great respect for that. I didn't particularly want to do that at this point. But having said that, publishing a book imprint, seeing your own book imprint, is a hoot.
It amounts to a much greater, it's interpreted by most people as a much greater democratization of media. Rick, how much so?
I believe that they're absolutely true. I think Jenny used a term a little while ago called gatekeeper.
Yeah.
And to me, the gatekeepers are the readers. If you listen to her process, you have an agent, you have an editor, then you have an editor who has to tell the folks above that editor how good this book is going to be and then get it out. That's a lot of steps. That's a lot of gatekeepers to let the public decide what they want to read and what they don't want to read. And to me, that's always a factor. I think most folks everybody deserves an opportunity to be published, and then let the readers decide if that's
right.
If that's a ballgame they want to get into.
Jenny, do more published titles in whatever format, including the e-format, do more published titles amount to more quality? Is that a net gain for the reading public?
I think that's the hardest question you have asked on this show, and it's a great interview with real depth to it. I mean, yes and no is what I would say. I agree with you both. The democratization is a wonderful thing, and of course the readers should decide. And the funny thing is that the readers really do decide. And one thing that Rick will probably be too modest to say is that he is a self-published author, but he has experienced tremendous success. He's a best-selling self-published author, which is an amazing thing. And I think whether you're traditionally published or self-published, being a bestseller is going to be a very rare little sliver of the pie. You know, just if you look at a curve of distribution, the bestsellers are always going to be small. And I think you can attain that status as a self-published author or a traditionally published author, but the quality is probably going to be about the same proportionately no matter where you go. Not every traditionally published book is great, as many people will tell you, and not every self-published book is great, but if you're able to find it, there are great books on both realms, and it's just the question is finding it. And I think Rick, you know, is painting kind of a wonderful picture of things that the reader decides, but that everything in publishing and writing comes with a cost. And one of the problems that we're facing with 250,000 new books being uploaded this year is, how does the reader find those great books? How do we find the Rick Mercer titles and the other ones that are really wonderful? And the statement Rick made about everybody deserves to publish a book, yes, you know, we live in America, and that's true, and we're all entitled to the pursuit of happiness, but does it present a problem for readers looking for great books? Yes, I think it does. Haven't solved it yet.
Rick, do you run into other authors who consider it still pretty desirable to be published by a big-name company?
Absolutely, and I think Jenny makes a lot of great points with the comment. I think that's still a dream that a lot of folks have, my approach is a little more pragmatic, like I said, a little more from a business standpoint. But the dream of having your book in print, the dream of having have an agent call you and say, "We got you published," is I mean, I can't imagine a higher high for an author who is seeking that kind of thing, you know. I think that's where the good vibes come from, the traditional side. I think that they have an opportunity to make someone's day with that kind of thing. And if that's what you seek, and Jenny is a model of seeking that at 13 years.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Rick Mercer is the author of Caribbean Moon. He is a self-published author from Holt, Michigan. Jenny Milchman is the author of Cover of Snow. She's published by Ballantine Random House. And tomorrow night, they'll gather at Schuler's in Okemos for a friendly debate on the merits of self-publication versus going the traditional route of finding a large publishing house. Jenny, Rick, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. It's been great.
New York's Carnegie Hall has launched a new initiative to bring an orchestra of young American musicians to the world stage. The newly formed National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America finished its audition process this month to form an ensemble 120 strong. The group will meet in New York in June to rehearse selected repertoire.
I think about a year ago, it must have been, maybe a little over a year, when Carnegie Hall first announced it. I think I saw it on their Facebook page that they were doing this new youth orchestra. And first of all, it hadn't occurred to me that a lot of countries have these youth orchestras, but the United States didn't until this point. And obviously, you know, the big names, Joshua Bell, Gergiev, that they that were connected with it impressed me. And, you know, I said, this sounds like a really good thing. And so I sent in an audition, and I think it was actually after I sent in the audition that I really read everything there was to read about it, and that's sort of when I got really excited about it and just all that it was going to offer.
Tell me a little bit more about the audition process. Was this all through recordings that you sent, or was there a live audition experience?
What I sent to them was several excerpts, video recording of several orchestral excerpts, a short solo piece, and they actually have you answer sort of an open-ended question on camera, just, I guess, to see what you're like doing something like that.
Sure. What was that question?
They gave three possibilities, and the one I chose was something like, or if your instrument had a personality, what would it be? And I talked about the violin. And
what did you say?
How great it is. I think I said something like, the violin is like a person who not only has interesting things to say, but the way they say things is also very interesting. So, like, they can command your attention even with a whisper or a gruff, scratchy voice, and sort of tied that into all the tone colors. I think the violin does really well.
So many have said, as you know, that the violin is the closest to the human voice than any instrument could be. What did you play for the audition?
Some excerpts from Mozart 39. The second violin fugue opening of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, last movement. And the one pretty standard one was the Mendelssohn Italian Symphony.
And what will you start working on in your first rehearsals?
We're doing this commissioned piece by Sean Shepard, which I think is in its final stages of work. Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with Joshua Bell, which will be amazing.
Great.
And Shostakovich 10th Symphony.
Oh, wow.
Very exciting.
What are you hoping for from this experience as you get ready to go join this orchestra?
A lot of things. Obviously, traveling will be amazing, and especially traveling to play music, which I think is one of the most special opportunities a young musician can have. I'm looking forward to meeting all of the other people who will be there. I just actually, when the roster came out a few days ago, I looked and I thought I would know, you know, a handful because the music world is so small, but I don't, and I know a couple, but I'm really excited to meet people from all over the world and, well, all over the country, and see what their views on music are. And then, of course, working with Gergiev and Joshua Bell. I mean, there's so much so much to be excited about.
Giancarlo Latta is a violinist from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He'll be one of the members of the National Youth Orchestra at Carnegie Hall. Giancarlo, thanks so much, and very best of luck to you.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
You've been listening to Giancarlo Latta of Ann Arbor, Michigan. He is one of a group of select players, the first members. He's one of the first members of the National Youth Orchestra of the United States. They have just finished their audition process this month, and he is a member of that 120-person ensemble. The group will meet in New York in June to rehearse selected repertoire. Then, after performances at Carnegie Hall in Washington's Kennedy Center, the National Youth Orchestra will perform on tour dates in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and London. And again, you've been listening to WKAR's Peter Worf with Giancarlo Latta, who is a senior at Ann Arbor High School, Pioneer High School. Well, we have got a counterpart of ours in the radio industry up at Interlochen Radio, WIAA, up in Interlochen, and they are taking their radio, their Roundup radio show on the road here this weekend to do a taping here in Lansing at Elderly Instruments tomorrow. Bill Dungeon is the host of the Roundup radio show, and he's here to tell us a little bit more. Hi, Bill.
How do you do?
I am well. Tell us about your program, Roundup Radio.
Well, you know, we're an old-time radio program, but we're sort of taking it in a modern direction, if you will. What we've been doing in Traverse City is we weekly, at a local bar, do an open mic night and record it and then edit it down for an hour show on our local college radio station. And that's gone so well, we've decided to handpick some guest artists and take it on the road. So our first show, like you say, will be at Elderly Instruments tomorrow, the 9th of March, Saturday, at 2 o'clock. It's a free performance at the store, and we'll be featuring some of the elderly staff, as well as Rulaine Stokes, who is a local, a Lansing poet, who does some instruction at the Michigan State University. We'll have Melting Moments. We'll provide a snack time for the audience, and we'll have our longest drive contest, where if you've come a long way, you can win a fabulous prize. It'll be great music, and then we'll edit that down and distill that into an hour-long broadcast for Interlochen Public Radio up in Traverse City.
There's a lot of talent on the staff at Elderly Instruments, and it's a well-known business, not just in Michigan, but really across the country. They've done an incredible mail-order business over the years, but it's a great bricks-and-mortar destination as well for just music lovers and players as well. You've got a lot of talent to choose from there at Elderly, just on the staff.
Yeah. Well, we're having Eldon Kelly will be with us. The fabulous Heftones and the Strangers in the Night Band will be out there, too. So we're real excited to hear all three of those acts. It was funny, last night we had a bit of a rehearsal with our house band, Sour Mash, the Bluegrass Boys, that roll up for the shows. And I would say out of a dozen instruments that we had with us, probably 10 of them were purchased at Elderly.
Now, you mentioned the open mic night, Bill. How much radio-ready talent do you have in northern Michigan?
Well, there's quite a bit. Last night, for instance, was our show, and we had a trio that came from, Milwaukee, Traverse City, and Paris, France. And they were fantastic. We had a young lady who was 11 years old who had just tore it up. Came in and played a tremendous blues tune that she had written and a couple other things. It's really a remarkable thing that we've got going up there in Traverse on Thursdays.
Bill Dungeon is the host of Roundup Radio on Interlochen Radio. He takes the show on the road this Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock here in Lansing. See him at Elderly Instruments. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, sir. Got it.
Current State here on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan State hockey team finished in last place this season. Their 12th place finish puts them in the position to play 6th-seeded Alaska in Fairbanks in the first round of the CCHA tournament. Lots of challenges facing the Spartans, including traveling to Alaska for the second time in just 2 weeks. Scott Moore is the radio voice of MSU Hockey on the Spartan Sports Network, and you hear him at the beginning of Current State every single morning, too. He joins us on the phone from Alaska to preview the series with the Nanooks. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning. We appreciate you joining us at this really early hour in Alaska.
The body clock hasn't quite set yet, so I'm still on Eastern time.
I can imagine. 2 years ago, MSU played a series in Alaska and then had to return 2 weeks later for the playoffs, just like this season. They got swept in that playoff series. Can they change that result this time?
Well, they got swept in that series, but it was a pair of overtime games, one of them going double overtime. So they were very, very close contests 2 years ago. And it all depends on which Spartan team shows up to play. It's been kind of an on-again, off-again relationship for the team for the last month or so. But, based on what we saw up here 2 weeks ago, where Michigan State beat Alaska 1-0 on Friday and then lost 4-2 with an empty net goal at the end on Saturday, those were very close games, and I expect nothing less.
Did Coach Anastas learn anything from those two that might help the team win this series?
I think he knows that his team can play with the Nanooks. I think that he knows that even though it's a 6-versus-11 matchup, that these two teams are not that far apart. And I think he also learned that he's got two viable goaltenders now. Will Yanikev came up here 2 weeks ago and played absolutely lights out against the Nanooks. The three goals that he gave up, the one empty netter, but the three goals that he gave up in the Saturday game were all power play goals. So none of them really were his fault.
Offense has been a problem this season. What can Michigan State do to score more?
I lost you there for just a second, Mark. Are you still there?
Sure. Yeah, I'm here, Scott. Offense, okay. Offense has been a problem. What can Michigan State do to score more?
Well, they just have to keep after the Nanooks and take the puck in a little bit wider than usual and cut out in front, I think. You've got an Olympic-size ice sheet here, so you've got an extra 15 feet to work with. The big thing that they have to watch out for is that with that extra 15 feet, they can't get caught making lazy passes across at the blue line. Those turn into turnovers and odd man rushes, and you just can't have those.
Are the Spartans getting strong play in goal, Scott?
They're getting very good play in goal. They had gone all season until 2 weeks ago without picking up a shutout. They had been involved in 3 1-0 games at that point and lost all three of them. Came up here, got a 1-0 win on Friday night with Will Yanikev in goal, and then last Saturday on Senior Day at Munn Arena, got another 1-0 win with Jake Hildebrand in goal. So both goaltenders are playing very, very well right now.
Traveling to Fairbanks is a huge issue, and this four-hour time difference is as well. The game is 11 o'clock Eastern time. Are the Spartans acclimating to that? Is that a concern?
The guys are ready to play, I think. And you get here, and that's why you travel a day early. We came up on Wednesday. Usually for CCHA series, we travel on Thursday. So you come up a little bit early. It gives you an extra day to acclimate and to get used to the difference in time. We got here Wednesday evening. The guys practiced that night. We practiced again last night before going out for a wonderful dinner at a place called the Turtle Club here, which is fantastic. And then by tonight, everybody's pretty much on Alaska time.
Scott Moore is the radio voice of MSU Hockey on the Spartan Sports Network. Scott, thanks, and have fun up there.
All right, I will. Thanks.
Coming up on Monday on Current State, we'll have an interview with Governor Rick Snyder on the big economic conference he's holding at Cobo Center in Detroit next week. We'll also find out exactly what a time bank is, and we'll have some laughs with comedian W. Kamau Bell, star of the FX show Totally Biased, and one of the headliners at Gilda's Laugh Fest that's happening all next week in Grand Rapids. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Instroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.